good?
This one's
on.
Oh.
It's King James Version. Okay. Emily, we will ask you a question. The next question coming up on the screen is, okay, so what world leaders, I'll give you more clue, what Canadian prime minister had his security fail to protect him against an attacker who pied him in the face?
I have no idea.
Do you remember who that was? Canadian prime minister.
I have a good memory, but it's short.
Do you want to make a guess?
No.
You guys remember who it was? Jean Chrétien. All right. The next question we will ask Pauline. So who is the significant leader behind the Invictus Games? The Invictus Games are an international adaptive multi-sport event in which wounded Army services personnel and veterans take part in sports. Who is the significant person behind it? The creator.
I don't watch sports, so I don't know.
No? Do you know who it is?
Prince Harry.
Prince Harry. Correct.
I normally would not
know. All right. Next question. What's the score, by the way? How many does Emily have? And how many does Pauline have? All right. For you, Pauline. What Pakistani woman lived through a Taliban assassination attempt in 2012 when she was only 15 years old because of her human rights advocacy, particularly focusing on the right women to be educated?
I remember that happening, but I don't remember her name.
Would you like to steal it?
I saw her every day and I don't know her name anymore. I have no idea.
Do you remember, anybody remember her first name at least? Malala. Yeah, Malala. So nobody got points on that. The next question for Emily, I believe. Yes. So what significant American political family saw two brothers assassinated within 5 years during the 60s? This is not for you, Pauline. This is for Emily. You get to steal it if she doesn't get it.
The Bush family?
No. Well, it's okay. It's not like she was alive.
Did I know this?
What,
it looked like I might, but I don't.
What American political family? Two brothers assassinated in the 60s. Are you right? All right. The answer is Kennedy family, John and Robert.
Oh.
All right. Next, what's the score?
Zero.
All right. So, Emily, this is for you. What American rock and roll band was originally put together for a mid-60s TV show and had several hits, including I'm a Believer?
Smash Mouth?
No.
They
did do a cover of that song, but no, that is not who it was. Do you know?
I'm going to have zero because I don't know that one either.
60s TV show bands?
Yes. I don't know.
The answer is the Monkees.
Oh, the
all right. Next question. Next one coming up. I want to make sure I go in the right. So, for Pauline. Okay. What Canadian rock band has sold over 50 million albums worldwide and yet has also become mocked as one of the worst bands in the world? I should say worst in the world. The name of the band. No?
No, I don't know.
Just so you know, you're doing about as well as Bob Robitaille did in the first
one. Oh, I'm so glad to hear that.
All right.
I don't feel as dumb now.
Do you know Emily?
Yeah, it's Nickelback.
Yes, it is Nickelback.
That would have been wrong.
Okay. Older generation. So, you need to look at the screen for this one.
Oh.
What is this symbol now most commonly called?
Hashtag.
Yes. Very good. All right, Emily, last question. Last question for you. What is the common name for the active tension between the U.S. and its allies and the Soviet Union and its allies that lasted from the late 40s until around 1990? Don't be giving clues. Don't be telling her the answer.
The Cold War?
Yes, it is the Cold War.
I was
just
going to name her in the morning.
All right. Very good. So what was the final score?
Emily won.
Emily won. All right. So your prize is your choice? Your consolation prize is your choice?
I still get a consolation prize. So let's see. That looks good.
All right. Very good. You guys can have a seat. I do not mind at all.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
You're welcome. So as you can see, there's a bit of a gap in generations. Most of us who knew both of them fall somewhere in the middle of the age spectrum. We're talking today about our second strategic initiative. Last week we talked about being a community church for our community. This week we're talking about being a church that's committed to next generations. And the reason we did that is because it's important for us to realize that next generations are different than us. That's always been true, but I think it may be more true now than it has ever been before. Some of the things that are different with generations. Next generations speak a different language than we are used to. For example, that hashtag and the initials and acronyms, it's amazing how much of that has made its way into actual verbal speech. The next generations have grown up in a world with computers and Instagram and, I was going to say Facebook, but that's old tech for those who are high school and younger. That's like, why would we be on that old thing called Facebook? I've heard like high school students say that. They speak a different language because of the digital age that they've grown up in. Nathaniel, I mentioned the person, he's doing a computer programming course at school. And so he'll come in and be like, yeah, we talked about this. And I look like I'm interested. I'm genuinely interested. I just have no clue what he's talking about. So next generations speak a different language than we are used to. Another thing that's different about next generations is they think differently about authority than we do. And when I say that, I don't mean that they are just rebelling against authority. They actually think differently about authority. You know, my generation and older, we thought the same about authority. We just rebelled against it. New generations actually think differently about authority structures than most of us were raised to do. Another difference is that next generations don't have the same religious background that many of us have. Last week, we talked about the number of people that are increasingly identifying as no religion on census data. Just to help you understand that in 2011, 23% of all Ontarians said they had no religion. 23% of the total population. Among those aged 15 to 24, that number was actually 32%. Almost one-third in 2011 in the 15 to 24 age group said they had no religion. So you have a lot of them that are growing up with no religion, but even those that say, well, identify with a religion, often don't identify with that religion in a way that older people in that tradition would identify with it. For example, a young person who says, I'm a Christian, could mean something totally different than their parents and grandparents meant by that word. They don't affirm the same things. Some actually have rejected consciously some of the things that traditional Christianity might have taught. Others have just never learned it. Maybe they identify with it because, well, I had to identify with it because of the school that I went to, and so I was baptized and took First Communion, so I must be Catholic. And they check off the box, and so they go on the census as being Christian, even though they don't affirm hardly anything that the Catholic Church would believe. Others might participate in religion or identify with a religion for reasons other than conviction. For example, I know I've met several times young people who, maybe when they were really little, they were raised in the church, and now they're in their early to mid-20s, and they have a baby, and they say, well, I haven't been a part of a church for a long time now, but I want my kid to raise with some type of moral guidance. And so they come to church so that their kid can learn moral values. It really has nothing to do with faith. It has to do with morals. So there's lots of differences. Just very quickly, we don't have a ton of time, but I'm just curious, what are some other observations that you can say, you know, I've noticed this about next generations. that is unique from previous generations. So saying they don't get along with their parents or grandparents, that's not a unique thing. Saying the music is different isn't a unique thing. That's been true for many, many generations. But what else about, like, sort of the early young adults and younger, would you say is something that you've observed is different about this generation than previous generations? Sorry, explain that. Yep. 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 And you said some key words. They actually feel like they have to live together. It's not like it's an option. It's a significant shift. You have something? Less patience? Okay. They want things to happen faster, sooner? Yep. Okay, explain that, Glenn. Okay. she says as her daughter prepares to go to university in the fall. But yes, there's a lot that tend to stay home longer or come back. Yeah. And anything else that you notice? Yeah, the world is much smaller. For me, I remember being stunned once I was actually watching a women's international football match in Hamilton, and Canada was playing against Colombia, and I was Facebook messaging a college student that I had worked with who was Colombian and living back in Colombia. I was Facebook messaging him in real time from the stands of the field. And for me, I was like, whoa, what am I doing? This is really weird. For younger generations, they've never known anything but that, right? The world is a much smaller place. Yeah, anything else? Yeah. Yeah. Another observation that was made is that due to the access of information, they interact with far more different ideas than my generation used to. I mean, we used to have to look it up in the Encyclopedia Britannica that was on the shelf at school if we wanted to find out information. And now it's like it's automatic. In fact, you don't even have to look it up anymore. You just talk to the little device on my counter and ask it a question. It will tell me all of the information. Right, so the access to information means we're exposed to a lot of different ideas and differences that we never were exposed to before, and that changes how we perceive people and how we perceive. Yep.
They share everything.
There's in some ways there's a lot more sharing. That, yeah. There's a sense of entitlement. Okay.
I think generally because of technology and the old days, people would have a lot of good friends because they may talk to you on the phone and so forth. But today, I think that the kids have fewer, much fewer true friends.
Okay.
A lot of.
Yep. Okay. I'm interested in hearing from those that are, under 30. Okay. I want to encourage you, we're going to keep going because we could talk like this all morning. But I want to encourage you to just talk with each other and hear from each other, even in the conversation after. And if you aren't sure, especially if you think you're sure, that you know what next generations are like, go talk to someone who is under the age of 30 and actually listen to what they have to say and find out. I actually, just incidentally, as people were leaving the first service, somebody who was part of the younger generation after this part of the service, I talked to them on the way out, and they said, you know, I felt like I was kind of getting bashed. Which I explained by saying, that's because when we were young, we got bashed by the previous generation. So now there's an element of, well, we had to hear it, so now it's our turn to get it. Explained that wasn't unique. But just so you know, sometimes how we speak does come across that way. We're talking about what it means to be a church committed to next generations. And the first bit that I want to just highlight, this is a story that many of us are familiar with, but just to say that next generations are important to God. He cares deeply about welcoming next generations. When people and parents brought their kids to Jesus, the disciples, they tried to put this block up and say, sorry, you can't come. And Jesus' response in Matthew chapter 19 was, let the little children come to me. Don't hinder them, for the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these. When he placed his hands on them, he went on from there. Not only did he welcome them, but he actually used them, saying, these ones that are younger, they're the ones that the kingdom belongs to. Next generations, younger people, are very, very important to God. I'm going to read a passage this morning from 1 Corinthians chapter 4. And this is Paul writing to a church that's got all kinds of issues. It's messy. I'm glad our church has no issues. No, I'm joking. One of my favorite lines was, there's no such thing as a perfect church. If there was, then you shouldn't come because you'll mess it up. I shouldn't go because I'll mess it up. Now, there's no perfect church. This is Paul writing to a definitely imperfect church in Corinth. And he adopts this posture of a spiritual parent that I want to take some notes from this morning. He writes this in 1 Corinthians chapter 4. I'm writing this not to shame you, but to warn you as my dear children. Even if you had 10,000 guardians in Christ, you do not have many fathers. For in Christ Jesus, I became your father through the gospel. Therefore, I urge you to imitate me. For this reason, I sent you Timothy, my son whom I love, who is faithful in the Lord. He will remind you of my way of life in Christ Jesus, which agrees with what I teach everywhere in the church. Some of you have become arrogant, as if I were not coming to you. But I will come to you very soon, if the Lord is willing, and then I will find out how these arrogant people are talking. I will find out not only how these arrogant people are talking, but what power they have. For the kingdom of God is not a matter of talk, but power. What do you prefer? Shall I come to you with a rod of discipline, or shall I come in love and with a gentle spirit? A few things in here that I just want to highlight about what it means to be a spiritual parent and some of the postures that Paul adopts. The first one is that spiritual parenting is about being a living example. Spiritual parenting is about being a living example. It's not primarily about having all of the answers. It's not about having all of the answers. Just like being a parent isn't about having all of the answers. Spiritual parenting isn't about being able to tell everyone everything and make sure that they understand everything exactly the way you do. Because the spiritual life is ultimately a journey, and it's about living that journey out so that they can see it, so they can follow it, so they can learn from it. One of the things that I hear most from leaders is that people who come on board to help teach kids or work with youth or work with young adults, I regularly hear, you know, I think I'm learning more than they are. Has anybody heard something like that or said something like that? Something happens when you come alongside someone to invest in them, and your life gets put on display in front of them, is actually you start to become more aware of actually how you're living and more conscious about what you're saying and what you're thinking about, and you start to be challenged to grow more. It's almost like a parent I knew, a friend of mine, who we were playing soccer together, and his son, who was 2 years old, was running around on the sidelines and started dropping the F-bomb several times, his little two-year-old. And his dad corrected him and said, stop talking like that. And then he turned, and like a light bulb went on, and said, I guess I shouldn't be surprised, because that's how he hears me talk all the time. And he realized, oh, wait, maybe if I want him to learn something else, maybe I need to learn to live a different way. And so pouring into others, being a living example, is not about being perfect. It's about allowing your life to be lived out in a way that, they can see and learn and follow. Paul talks about this when he writes, saying, you know, I want you to follow me. Live like me. Imitate me, because he's following Jesus. Spiritual parenting starts by being willing to be a living example. The second thing I want to highlight here is that spiritual parenting is about passing on a sincere living faith. In verse 17, Paul writes, I want you to imitate me. That's why I'm sending you Timothy, my son whom I love, who is faithful in the Lord. Timothy's got this sincere journey. And so Paul says, I want you to look like me. And Timothy is living this out. So I'm sending him to you because he's got this faithfulness that I want you to learn from. Paul, when he writes to Timothy, and he writes a couple of letters to Timothy that are in the Bible. And the first one, we call it very profoundly, 1 Timothy. He writes to him, and he describes Timothy this way. He actually saying to Timothy, he says, I am reminded of your sincere faith. I'm reminded of your sincere faith. That's what Timothy has. That's his faithfulness. It's his sincerity. It's a real faith. Again, a sincere faith is not one that is perfect. It's not one that has all of the answers. A sincere faith is one that has the warts and has the struggles and has the doubts, but it's still continuing to journey. Interestingly, when Paul wrote to Timothy, he said, I'm reminded of your sincere faith. And then he's going and says, which first lived in your grandmother, Lois, and in your mother, Eunice. And I'm persuaded now lives in you also. Timothy received that sincere faith. He learned that sincere faith from those who went before him, who passed it on to him. A sincere faith. A sincere faith. So spiritual parenting is about having this living example, passing on a sincere living faith. You know, one of the things that my experience with next generations is that drives me crazy is when things seem fake. When things don't seem real. Ironically, they express that while they're putting posed pictures on Instagram, but that's a whole other topic. They get frustrated by fakeness of stuff, and they want to know that something is real and genuine. And if it's always perfect and clean and shiny, it's probably not perfect. It's probably it doesn't feel even human to them, let alone living. The third thing, sincere parenting is about passing. Where am I going? Living example. There we go. Spiritual parenting is about being willing to dig into the hard stuff. You know, we talked about the gap between generations. Even people 10 years younger than me, we didn't have to grow up with the access to the world in our pocket on our cell phones, where everyone was able to message us, where there was an expectation that we would respond like that to every kind of thing that we received. There's a reason. I think that's part of the reason why anxiety levels among college students are higher than they have been in a very, very long time. But spiritual parenting is about being willing to dig into the hard stuff. I mentioned those differences because they're wrestling with stuff that we were actually told, well, you don't talk about that. You know, things that weren't even on our radar, they're now regular conversation points. And so sometimes they might be really hard for us to dig into. You know, I'll use sex ed as an example. You know, my parents' version of sex ed was, we bought you this book, here you go, and then, like, leave me alone. It's the stuff that wasn't talked about is we need to be willing to have those conversations. The challenge that comes for those of us who are of an older generation is we don't know how to talk about it. We have no clue, and that's okay. Because when you don't know something, you have to start by listening, which is exactly what is needed. It's actually good sometimes that we don't know because we have to actually hear and listen and try and understand. Rather than, if you think you know everything, then you're just going to start giving out answers. And that doesn't cut it for people who are asking deep questions. Probably the one of the biggest things for me in terms of being willing to dig into the hard stuff and having my little bubble of you can't talk about this stuff burst. I was working with college students and a young man came to our Bible study and participated and active and clearly had Bible background and a sincere faith. And just hearing him pray was just passionate and wanting to follow Jesus. And then he said, you know, when we're done, can I talk with you and Angie? I said, sure. So can we talk in private? Okay, sure. First week I'd met him. So we go up to the office, and he proceeds to just say, hey, what do you know about transgender? I said, nothing. I don't know anything. And he proceeded to talk about growing up in the church, wanting to follow Jesus, and his whole life was spent looking male on the outside and feeling female on the inside, from when he was the youngest that he can, any youngest possible memory, and having this dysphoria, this struggle between what people saw and what he felt, and it was not something he chose, and the pain that he had with that, and how he had found acceptance out in the community, but as one who wanted to follow Jesus, he hadn't found that in the church, and he was looking for a place that he could grow in his faith and be welcomed and accepted to struggle on his journey with Jesus. As I said, I can tell you two things. I don't know anything, but I will work to learn, and I'd love to sit with you and try and listen and hear your story, and to walk with you as, and just to try and learn. Second thing is, yeah, come, be here, be welcome, join us in this. And we walked that journey together for a year and a half before, until he graduated, and then we moved away. But that was hard, because that's not the kind of thing you're supposed to talk about. In fact, when I brought it up with the leaders at our church, with our board at our church, I said, just so you know, this is what's happening. Their exact response was, I'm glad it's you, not me. Let's not talk about that anymore. To give you an idea of the pain that this student was living through, he said to me, the only reason I have not taken my own life is because I was raised in the church and I don't believe that I should take my own life. But the pain that I feel is such that I've been trying to figure out, how do I resolve this tension, get rid of this pain, and still honor Jesus. And the only way, until he found support outside of the church, the only way he had figured out to resolve it was he was going to become a missionary. And he was going to intentionally go to the single most dangerous part of the world, where it was a very good chance that he would get killed as a missionary. Because then he would be pleased God, because he was a missionary and he was a martyr, and his pain would be gone. That's how much pain this guy had. And I had to walk into that hard stuff. I didn't have answers. That's an extreme example, but we have to be willing to walk into difficult stuff. The worst thing that we can do is say, as parents or the spiritual parents, to say, I don't understand that, so I'm not going to talk about it. That's too hard. I'm not sure about that, so I'm going to just stay over here. We need to be willing to walk into the hard stuff with people if we're going to be able to be effective with next generations. And that leads to the last point, is that, in summary, the spiritual parenting is ultimately about showing love. When Paul wrote to Timothy, this Timothy that he sent to the Corinthian church, he's going to deal with stuff. This is what he told him. He said, don't rebuke an older man harshly, but exhort him as if he were your father. Treat younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, and younger women as sisters, with absolute purity. It needs to be this familial love that they can come and know. One of the things, you know, parents, we get the worst from our kids. Have you noticed that? They go to school and they're fine. They come home and it all comes at us, because they feel the sense of safety and security. They can let it all out at us, knowing that they're still going to be welcomed. That's the context we're supposed to create. This type of familial love that says, you know, bring the hard stuff, bring the garbage, bring it here, let us have it, because we're still going to love you. There's lots of reasons that people don't engage next generations, but my basic question is, who can you interact in ways that you're living well among them, that you're passing along a sincere faith, that you're willing to dig into the hard stuff, and ultimately you're willing to show love? I hear people say, you know, I couldn't do that, I'm too old now. I couldn't do that because I don't understand what they're talking about. I couldn't do that because I don't have the answers. I couldn't work with kids because, and there's lots of reasons that people give. Some are legitimate in terms of busyness or schedule or genuine health issues to a certain extent. But most of the best youth workers I know, and young adult workers I know as an example, have not been 20-somethings. They have been people who are in their 50s at least, you know, my friend Mark, who is in his 50s now, and he has, for as long as I've known him, worked with junior high boys, and he's not quitting. Like he, the older he gets, the more he wants to work with junior high boys. And he's there week after week at his church in the States, and they make fun of his Canadian accent, and he goes and cheers them on in their games, and they talk about Jesus together, and they absolutely love him, and he loves them. My friend Isaac, who ran the youth group for years, not because he had to, but because he wanted them to help to see Jesus. Isaac, again, in his 50s. My friend Nadia, she's a young adult. She's about 6 feet tall, from Kenya, dark skin. Add on top of the 6 feet, about another 6 inches of her hair wrapped up. Who I had the chance to baptize her in her early 20s as she was finishing up at Sheridan College. We talked, you know, what were some of the most significant things in your spiritual journey so far? And she talked about there was a semester at the beginning of her program where she wasn't going to school, but because of her student visa, she couldn't work. She was trying to figure out, what am I going to do with my time during this semester? So she went to the ladies' Bible study at the church across the road. And this ladies' Bible study, average age, low estimate would be around 70, probably closer to 75, of these European women who welcome this African young woman in and say, come sit with us. Let's sit together. Let's get to know each other. Let's study the Bible together. She says, that was one of the, like, they loved me. They welcomed me. They cared for me. This girl from halfway around the world who looked different than them. And they didn't judge me. They didn't question me. They put up with my questions. And it was one of the most profound growing experiences I've ever had, because they were willing to do this with her. I think of my friends Jim and Daphne. Jim and Daphne were in their 50s. Their youngest son was in college, but most of their kids were past that. And we were talking about, how do we care for college students? And Jim just said to me, honestly, in a board meeting, he said, I love them, but I don't know what to say to them. I'm afraid to talk with them because I don't know what to talk about. And I said, well, don't worry about what you're going to talk about. Just give it a shot. Walk across the room. Talk to them. Ask them about themselves. Listen to them. Just engage them and find out about them. Just give it a shot. That following Sunday, he gets up from where he is on one side, walks across the auditorium to talk to a girl named Dan. And he chose to talk to Dan because Dan was from mainland China and he could speak the same language. So he starts talking to Dan. Next thing I know, Jim's wife, Daphne, comes running out to me. John, you have to come in and talk to Dan. Well, why? She says she wants to get baptized. It's like, oh, okay. She's been in Canada for like 5 months, and she'd never heard about Jesus before that. Like, so I come in, find out that she really doesn't understand what baptism is quite, but she wants to follow Jesus. And so Daphne looks at me and says, we need to go talk to her. I said, no, I don't need to go talk to her. She hardly speaks English. You speak her language. Why don't you go talk to her? And Daphne had the opportunity that Sunday morning to sit with her at the front of the church and pray with her as Dan said, I want to follow Jesus. Because they were willing to walk across the room, not knowing what they were going to say or what they were going to talk about. Joyce isn't here this morning, but I want to talk about Joyce Cannell this morning. She started coming because she could help with meals once in a while when they were doing dinners, and she enjoyed that, and she enjoyed the students, but she wasn't sure she wanted to keep coming beyond that because wasn't sure that she could do senior high stuff. And yet Kyle and others convinced her, you know, keep coming. And now when she is here, when you see Emily and Sarah, when they walk in, they run and give her a big hug, not because Joyce has all of the answers. In fact, probably because she doesn't. Because she does this week after week, coming. And so, you know, we don't do running around games with senior high, because Joyce will just sit out. We do board games and other games that we can all participate in together. And she loves it, and she is loved because she's living well. She's not showing a perfect face. She's showing a sincere face. She digs into the hard stuff, and ultimately she shows love. So who can you find that you can live like this with? As I got thinking about this, I got thinking about my own experience growing up. And so I just want to close by reading a poem that I wrote that I think kind of reflects some of my own growing up experiences and some of the way I think we can posture ourselves as we be a church that is committed to next generations. My shoulder hurts. My hip and my ankle too. I'm aware of it in my age, but the injury is from long ago. You see, I am a square. At least my son thinks I am. I'm a square like my parents once were round. They, the product of their time and space, sought to make me a product of their time and space. And not them alone, their peers, their friends, their generation. They, in love, sought to protect, but perhaps to the expense of patience and hope. And so they gripped me. They gripped me tight. Not me alone, but my peers, my friends, my generation. They gripped tight, and they twisted, and they manipulated. They forced. Squares tried to be forced into their round hole. And it hurt. It hurt where I was grabbed. It hurt where I was twisted. It hurt where square corners were met with knife and sandpaper trying to push me in. And yes, it came from love. And yes, it caused pain. And now I, a product of my time and space, and the older generation, somewhere, without me realizing when, the tools were put into my hands. I have others, children of my own and children of others in front of me, and they don't fit in my square. What am I going to do? I must choose. I can be for me and my square, my shape, my design, and force and trim and cut and manipulate. Grip hard, leaving marks and scars where none were before. Or I can be for them, like the red and blue ball with yellow shapes, gently holding them, observing them, seeing the shape God has given them, honoring that shape, and helping them find just their right fit. I used to think Jesus only had one shape. I often find myself thinking that still. And the shape I see in Jesus is remarkably just like me. My language, my complexion, my habits, my theology, my age. But I am not the exact representation of God's being. Jesus is. And Jesus doesn't look just like me. Yes, I long to look just like Jesus. But I will only ever look like a small part of Jesus. We are his body. Maybe I'm only a small toe or the flappy skin on the elbow. The beauty and power of Jesus is that he is not a square or a circle. He's not a triangle or a star. Each of these, created in the image of God, can become like Jesus because the shape is an outward appearance. And that, well, that's not what God looks at. Father, as we seek to be a church that is committed to next generations, I ask that you would help us to lean into who you have made us to be. Not trying to be something that we're not, but to lean into who you have made us to be on a sincere faith and a sincere journey. And that as we do that, as we show love, we would invite those who speak a different language and come from a different place and think differently to most of all see you. And to discover who you are and exactly how you have made them to be as followers of Jesus on this road. God, I thank you that you have been so patient with us that in spite of our mistakes and the mistakes of those who have gone before us, that you still continue to bring us to you. I ask that you would help us to receive grace as we seek to bring others along behind us and invite them on this journey. And that we would show each other grace as we continue this road. In Jesus' name, amen.